Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
This country was built on a distinctly American work ethic. But today, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and diminished our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make a variety of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more. All made right here in the USA, from growing the cotton to adding the final touches. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs for seamsters, cutters, and factory workers in towns and cities across the United States. And it's about more than an income. Jobs bring pride, purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
Thought I'd start off the show with it this time.
It is a better opener. Maybe just get rid of the theme music.
We're going to have more Woo tonight as Josh and I continue our conversation with Alex. If you didn't catch last week's episode, you probably want to check that out first because it lays the groundwork for this episode. Alex tells us about his return trip to the same area. He brought two friends. They end up seeing a creature. They end up seeing strange lights. They leave gifts. They see what appears to be little fairies dancing around their gifts. Very, very interesting. And it continues from there because he returns several more times. Before we get to Alex, I want to thank our patrons. Thank you so much, patrons. Thanks for everything you do. We could not do Strange Familiars without your help. If you want to help us make Strange Familiars and get more content besides, you can go to patreon.com/strangefamiliars and become a patron. There's different tiers of support there. No matter what tier of support you choose, you're helping us make Strange Familiars, and you're getting extra content. We do 2 full extra episodes of Strange Familiars for our patrons every month, so check it out. Again, that's patreon.com/strangefamiliars. And speaking of patrons, one of our patrons, longtime supporter of the show, Maynard, is in rehab after an operation for his foot. He's unable to work. He needs a little financial help. He's got a GoFundMe. We're going to put the link in the show notes. If you can help Maynard out, go ahead and do that, please. You can find the link to his GoFundMe at strangefamiliars.com under this episode. And Maynard, I hope you feel better soon. All right, let's go ahead and get to the second part of our talk with Alex.
So
So do you start doing research on this before you go back, or did you go back just like, you know, take a friend back and like, hey, like, you got to come out here and I'll show you where this happened or something like that?
Yeah, so I wrote up the account of what happened and I posted it on Reddit, and I posted it to like the Missing 411 subreddit, because like that was like one of the first things that I came across when I started Googling like the weather thing and Bigfoot, and it's like, oh, David Politis, and it's, I don't know how I feel about all that necessarily, but I posted my account on there and I got like these recommendations for like these documentaries and like avenues of research that I could go down. And the first thing that I watched was the Missing 411 Hunted documentary, and they have a segment in there about the Sierra Camp and the Sierra Mountains in California and the recordings that they made in the 70s. And it's like, wait a minute, this is exactly what I experienced. So that was kind of my first foray into the whole Bigfoot thing, was through Ron Moorhead, and you know, he's got his own ideas about what it is, and that's cool. But I've since kind of like branched off of this whole phenomena being exclusively a giant monkey person with psychic power. So
yeah.
I mean, you guys know what I'm talking about. Yeah. So I explain everything, what happened to my roommate. I kind of like tentatively tell him what happened. I leave out certain details, like the psychic stuff, or like the thought patterns and the mind speak or whatever, for good reason, I think, because anyone who doesn't know what that is probably going to think it's some kind of mental.
Yeah, I mean, it's a crazy enough, like, when you tell this stuff, it's crazy enough as it is. And then you start adding that stuff in and people are like, okay, I'm out.
Right. Yeah, you mentioned, and I listened to the last episode that you did, and you mentioned like the overwhelming kind of thing where you like, oh, and then I saw a UFO, and then like I saw Bigfoot. It's like, okay, like this is too much for anyone to like believe. So you kind of have to leave out details in a way.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's what I did. And, I showed him that documentary, and I was like, dude, this is exactly what happened. Or like,
I was just going to say, so sometimes I think that this compounding of bizarre elements that aren't supposed to be related, quote unquote, is a deliberate technique used by the phenomena. I mentioned this in an essay that I've got coming out in another collection of essays, not that collection of essays, but a different collection of essays that's coming out soon. And there's a screenwriting line of thought that says that you can't engage in a bunch of double mumbo jumbo, which is like, you can have vampires or you can have men from Mars. You can't have vampires from Mars, right?
Right.
Unless you're like doing some sort of like, you know, send up that's sort of a tongue-in-cheek velocipastor or something like that, right? And because you wreck the audience's disbelief. And sometimes I wonder, I put this forth in this essay, that like maybe that's a deliberate ploy to sort of remain in that marginalized area that these things tend to prefer to dwell in.
Jacques Vallée talks about like how the phenomena negates itself through absurdity.
Sure, yeah.
You know?
And yes, 100%.
And the more I talk to people, and again, I've talked to some people who've been on other podcasts, and they were just like, well, they didn't want to talk to me about the ghost and UFO stuff. They only wanted to talk to me about the Bigfoot stuff, right? Or they, you know, it was a ghost podcast, and they didn't want to hear about the UFO stuff.
Right.
And it's gotten to the point where I don't know that it's more common for people to have multiple things happen, but it's quite common for people who've experienced one thing to experience other things. And I know this just from talking to witnesses. Every week I talk to them, the number of people who have multiple things is, it's not small. Let's put it that way. A lot of times, if one thing happens, people have other things as well. So you're telling your roommate. Sorry, we threw you off track. You're telling your roommate about this.
Yeah. So I show him that documentary. I basically like browbeat him. You know, trying to this is what happened, man. Like I'm not lying. I realize like I'm not. You know, I'm rational about this whole thing. Like I understand that what I'm saying sounds insane. You know, so I'm not like trying to obsess too much over it, but it's almost impossible for me not to, just because getting past like the whole trauma aspect of it, it's an intensely fascinating event, you know, and not only just because it happened to me, just because it's like, you know, wait, Bigfoot's real? Like, I never would have thought that ever, unless this had actually happened, you know? So yeah, I start doing like research. This also unlocks a whole bunch of like memories that I had tried, I don't know why, but for whatever reason had like completely wiped from my mind, or like my day to day. Like I had seen a UFO before when I was in school in Seattle at a frat party. So this was around like 2017. I was at a outdoor backyard frat fraternity party, which I don't normally go to. I'm not part of that whole thing. I just went because, like, my friends were there. And I think I had, like, a beer, but obviously they don't – alcohol does not make you see these types of things. But just for full honesty and disclosure, that's what I was drinking. It's like a Bud Light or something bad. And I'm talking to this guy from University of Michigan, I remember. I can't remember his name. I should probably look him up, but just so I can corroborate this story somehow. But for whatever reason, I get this feeling that I should look up, and I do, and I see this glowing green egg-shaped object in the sky, like behind the clouds. I can see like the clouds passing over it, and it's very distinctly ovular, you know, like an egg. And I look up, and I say, "Hey, what's that?" And he looks up, and he's like, "Hey, that looks like a UFO." And then as soon as he says that, it zooms off like a bullet, like extremely fast to the left and just disappears. And that was probably, yeah, that was definitely the first thing that I had ever seen visually that was, I would consider paranormal. I think it's important because another person saw it. So.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. It kind of unlocked that memory. Another memory that it unlocked was, I remembered that I had had dreams when I was a kid, and I find this interesting because normally, like, I can't remember dreams at all, but especially from, like, age 5 or 4, you know? But I remember a dream that I had when I was a very little kid of little people in my room running around and, I don't know, like, destroying things or, I don't know, just causing a nuisance or something. I don't remember exactly the motives or what they were doing necessarily, but it didn't seem very pleasant. They had like little pointy heads or pats or something. You know, I had like a book on gnomes or something when I was a kid. There's like this famous, like very well illustrated book on gnomes. I can't remember what it was or who wrote it.
I know which one you're talking about.
Yeah. That's so funny. I remember that dream so distinctly. And again, it was like one of those like hyper real, very distinct memories that I had. Another one that I remembered was a little bit older, maybe like 10 or 11. My brother and I used to share a bedroom, and I remember waking up and seeing with my eyes, this was not in a dream state, a little person covered in hair running down the hall and jumping into my brother's bed and then disappearing. And my brother was in the bed, so there's no possible way that it was him. And again, this is one of those memories that I just completely blocked out forever until this Bigfoot thing happened. So this whole thing kind of released a whole bunch of stuff that my brain, for whatever reason, kind of blocked out.
It recontextualizes it as well.
Yeah. That's a great way of putting it. Actually.
Yeah. I mean, just, again, you know, kind of similar things, not the same dreams, but I've had dreams that I remember that I thought were recurring dreams. I knew I was awake, but when I was a kid, but as you know, looking back, I was like, oh, they just must have been recurring dreams until I started getting into this stuff, and it changed the whole nature. It just really recontextualized them.
Right.
So, yeah.
Because I remember thinking at the time when I was a kid, like, huh, that was strange, but I had never, I didn't have any context for what that possibly could have been, so I kind of just wrote it off as a waking dream or something like that.
Right. And, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That was very interesting to remember all that. So yeah, do you guys want to hear about what happened when I went back?
Absolutely. How long in between was there before you went back?
Okay. So I went the first time in August, mid-August. I had a little time to tell my roommate, tell my friend. I brought two other guys with me, my friend Steven, my friend Julian, who is my roommate. And I had a little time to like explain, like, this is a thing that has happened to other people. You know, like, look at this and this and like, look at this documentary. Like, I basically had, yeah, I had time to tell them this was not just a hallucination or some kind of like manic episode or whatever. Not that that has ever happened to me before, but they were open to it, I'll say. But they were definitely going and like, ah, this is fun. Like, oh, we're going to go look for Bigfoot. This is hilarious. Not exactly that way, but a little bit more nice about it, which I appreciate. So they were not expecting anything to happen is what I'm trying to say. So we go in November. I think it was November 19th, so like a couple months after. And when we get there, we basically just set up our camp. It's the exact same spot. I am very nervous because, again, like I'm still highly traumatized by what happened. I'm still feeling very paranoid and like I just want them to see the location, basically. I don't necessarily need anything to happen. We set up our camp. We do a little bit of exploring because it's not raining, and I'm feeling a little bit more safe with other people there.
Mm-hmm.
We walk up the hill to where I heard like the first thing walk down from. So I'm like, all right, let's just go see what's up there. Maybe there's something. And up on this hill is like a big line of boulders. And it looks kind of like a spinal column almost. But there's just like a bunch of big rocks. And we decide to sit on them for a little bit and just like wait and just see what happens. And as we're walking up, my friend Julian says, like, hey, I'm feeling like this weird thing in my spine, like this weird like electrical shock. That's never happened before. It's like, oh, wait a minute. That, like, did I tell you that that's what happened to me? And I don't think I had at that point. So like that was the first thing that weird that happened to him. So as we walk up, he starts feeling that strange sensation. We decide to sit on these rocks. Steven starts to become nauseous for some reason, which I find interesting. And he walks back down to the camp to go lie down because he's feeling ill, which is an odd detail, I think.
No, that's a thing. Yeah, that's an important detail. Yeah,
I know that now. He walks down. We wait a little bit. And then Julian taps me on the shoulder. And then he says, Alex, hey, look over there. What is that? And about 50 feet away, behind a tree, is a little hairy, black-haired person or something. I don't know. Like a little black-haired humanoid. And it's peeking out behind a tree, and it's like bobbing back and forth, like swaying.
Wow.
Side to side. And obviously that was a very affirming moment, but also very, I don't know how else. Yeah. It was just one of the weirdest things I've ever seen in my life.
Tons of questions here.
Sure.
Yeah. How tall, roughly?
It was short. It was like 5 feet tall. It was little. It's not big.
Could the body type, can you, you know, was it skinny, you know, bulk, broad?
It was not bulky. It didn't have a neck. Its shoulders met its head. I don't know if that's because its traps were super big or if it was just like hunched up. I don't know. But like, it didn't seem to have a neck. Shoulders were pretty wide. I remember this. Oh, this is a weird detail. You know how an orangutan has like the hair that falls off its elbows? That's kind of longer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, it had that, like, it had long hair off the elbows, which I find is a very interesting detail. Yeah, and it was just like swaying back and forth.
Could you see any face details at all?
No. So Julian was sitting on a rock higher than I was, so he saw the face. He saw a face. He describes it as like a child, like a kid.
Wow.
Said it had like a confused, inquisitive look on its face. He actually drew it, and I can send you the picture of the drawing later. But
did he describe the skin color at all? Or
I think he said it was like dark skin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we don't say anything.
So he's an instant believer at this point, I'm guessing. I
mean, yeah. You can talk to him now, and he says, "Yeah, we saw a little hairy monkey man."
So, wow.
And he, you know, he kind of has like a different approach to all this. Like he's he went to art school, and he likes, you know, he likes all the creative stuff. So he's like, oh, it's so cool that, like, you know, he doesn't really have, like, the, dude, this is kind of important, you know, like, Bigfoot's real. Like, this kind of implies a whole bunch of other crazy stuff, too, you know. But
right.
I don't think he really thinks about it that much, honestly. But, you know, if you talk to him, he's like, that's what we saw. So after a while, it kind of just, like, disappears behind the tree, and we don't see it again.
How long would you guess that it was there, or that you saw it, rather?
Probably around like 5 minutes.
Oh, wow. Like, that's a good long time. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. It was standing there for a while, and we were just like, I didn't feel fear. You know, I felt fine. I felt totally safe, which is interesting. You know, I felt very calm, very relaxed. I'm just like, oh, this is so great. Like, Julian doesn't think I'm crazy. Finally, like, not that he did necessarily, but I just felt very affirmed, very pleasant, and just like not necessarily happy because I'm just so freaked out, you mm-hmm. know, but. Yeah, I was not feeling the paranoia or the fear at that moment. So yeah, we see that, it disappears. We walk down the hill back to the tent, and we don't say anything. I think we just kind of know that what we just saw was pretty intense and pretty important. And I'm so exhausted emotionally and mentally at that point, so I just kind of crawl in the tent, and I'm like, oh, thank you for doing that. I really appreciate it. I'm just going to go to sleep and then go home. I don't need to obsess about this anymore because I proved it to my friend. So,
what has your life been like after all this? I mean, relationships, outlook, etc. I mean, any noticeable changes? Or
it has definitely been a positive for me, a net positive.
Really? Okay. Yes.
Yeah, I don't feel haunted by demons or like possessed, or you know, because like I've talked to other people in the paranormal realm. It's like, dude, like, why do you gotta be so paranoid about this? It's not that. I mean, from my experience, these things don't want to hurt you, or if they, maybe they even can't. I don't know. Maybe these things exist in a realm between the dream and the real world or something, you know? Like, I don't necessarily, I don't know. I find this too interesting not to devote a significant portion of my energy to research. Also because I find, like, there's not a whole, besides, like, your podcast, and I think, like, Hellier, that documentary did a pretty good job of contextualizing, like, the phenomenon in a way that, mm-hmm. is not like History Channel or like Boomer extremely boring documentaries, which are all over Amazon.
Right.
I'm sure you guys know what I mean.
Yeah, or another congressional hearing.
Yeah, right. And it's like, okay, so that's interesting you bring that up, because it's like, whenever I hear people talk about UFOs, it's like, bro, you don't know what you're talking about. You know what I mean? It is such a huge spectrum of separate and connected phenomena that when you just talk about, well, like, Navy pilots saw a mysterious object that, like, well, it maneuvers not like a drone. It's like, dude, are you going to bring up the fact that this is related to the occult ever? I don't think you are. So,
I think in a way you had an advantage in that your introduction to the phenomena from the outset kind of told you this is something more than a monkey in the woods, right?
Yes. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. What?
And I would add to that, Tim, an advantage in the fact that, you know, short of being taken by one of these things somewhere, they don't get much more harrowing than what you experience.
Oh, honestly. Yeah. Oh,
yeah. I have not found another encounter that's like, as, I mean, I'm 100% positive there have been, you know, because these things, I'm certain these things go back forever to hunter-gatherer time. So I'm positive that there are accounts or encounters that have happened that are much more intense than mine, but I have not found any that might be, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's whatever it is, I think it's a traveling companion with us. I really do.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree.
So you go back to your tent. So is it getting towards nightfall now?
Yeah, so this is the next step of the this whole thing for me, is what happens next.
Okay.
So I get in the tent, I kind of like lie down, I pass out because I'm so exhausted mentally and emotionally. I wake up to Julian and Steven saying, Alex, get out here, there's something in the tree. And I get out, and there's this cluster of bluish white orbs just sort of swaying in like a figure eight motion up in the canopy. And it's nighttime at this point because I'd passed out for a little bit, and we had gotten there later than the first time I'd been there. So it was around like 5 p.m. when we saw the little hairy guy. So it's dark, probably like 7 or 8. And yeah, there's just this cluster of like 6 to 7 baseball sized orbs just hovering very, very close to us up in the trees. And they're making this weird kind of like, swaying figure eight pattern motion. And we look at it and everyone's like, you know, what is happening right now? Like, no one's super scared, but there's definitely a lot of excitement and energy happening. Everyone's like, oh my God. Yeah. And I'm kind of just silent because I'm like, wait a minute. Like, I didn't, like, you guys don't have to do anything else. You know, it's cool that you showed yourselves. Like, we can kind of just go home now. Like, this is great.
Yeah. They're going to believe me now.
So. Yeah, right. Yeah. Exactly. So, yeah, they're just hovering there for a long time. You know, they just stay there. And I look behind us and there's another cluster, and then as it gets darker, more of them show up and they start to like zoom in circles around us in the canopy. I don't know how to describe the emotional state I was in, but it's, you know, it's shock. It's not fear, but it's just a state of shock, basically.
I'm sure that somewhere in the ufological literature, that figure eight pattern has been repeated, but it also puts one in the mindset of the falling leaf pattern that you hear associated with UFOs, which also, you know, apports and poltergeist cases have that same sort of pattern a lot of times. Yeah,
so that's interesting you bring that up. And I'm so happy that you know about that, because that's one of the details that I find the most interesting is that motion. So the phenomena of Fatima, I'm positive you guys know what that is. They describe it like a falling leaf. There are a lot of accounts in Dimensions by Jacques Vallée, which is an awesome, awesome book of, yeah, basically the same thing of, like, there's like some Japanese general in like the 13th century that described the same thing. He called them like swaying stars or something like that. Johann Goethe, the German poet, described basically the same thing in his like fairy encounter on his way back home from Italy, I believe. There's so many like details that correspond to what I saw personally, which is so crazy. It's so awesome. But yeah, so it's making this motion. They kind of dissipate after a while. It's funny. They're there for so long. We don't really get bored of looking at them, but it's like, it becomes kind of just like, all right, yeah, that's cool. Like they're there. They're just there hanging out with us, you know? And we start a fire and we're just sitting around it. And we start to hear like wood knocks up, like really up high, like this loud banging sound. Again, yeah, it sounds like someone with a stick hammering on a tree up high in a tree, which is funny. And that's like super close by. And now this is a detail that I normally leave out of most every retelling of this encounter, because it is almost too intense or too unbelievable for people to handle. But I'm going to tell you guys, because I know that you appreciate the interesting details. This is when the military showed up. And obviously, I knew that the military hung out in this area, but I didn't expect them to appear in that spot at this time. And it I'll give some context to it, because I know when I say that, it's like, that's just too crazy for people to believe. But again, you can ask both of these dudes and they will tell you the exact same thing of what happened that night. We get in the tent because we're going to go to sleep. We had left out like some little treats for them in front of our campsite, or from in front of our fire pit, and it's completely extinguished. Not a single burning coal is left. It's an important detail. Because what happens is, at the little gifting site, and I had read about gifting and like thought that might facilitate some kind of response or something. I didn't really think it might, but I just thought it was worth a try. But it turns out it did, because what happened at the gifting site was little orange. They looked like little fairies or something. Like it looked like a little winged creature, but it did not behave like an insect. The fact that they were localized to that particular spot is too much of a coincidence for me to believe that it was some kind of bug or like, you know, I don't know what else it could be, that besides like a little fairy orb or something, but it looked like it had wings. It was glowing orange, like a little burning coal, but they were floating in the air and they looked like they were dancing in a circle around it. I don't know how else to describe it. Just they look like they're dancing from being happy that we left them like little chocolate peanut butter cups or something.
Now, you're seeing this before you get into your tent, or are you seeing this from your tent?
We're seeing this from the tent. We're all facing out, looking at it.
Okay.
And again, like everyone's like completely dumbfounded. Like, what is happening right now?
Wow. You know,
no one's scared necessarily, but it's definitely like very heightened state of mind everyone's in. That is when we start to hear a bunch of people coming down the trail, and it is 20 to 30 dudes with rifles and backpacks, and the lights disappear, and we are like incredibly scared that we are about to like be murdered by the army or something. And it's like they don't see, I mean, I don't think they see us. They ignore us if they did, but they walk down the trail, which is probably 50 feet away from us, so very, very close, and they just walk by us, and then they just keep going. And Stephen was convinced that we were about to get murdered or something, or, you know, like be told this is a private area. I don't know. Something bad was about to happen, but nothing did. But yeah, like literally training army dudes. I think they're training because they had like the little simunition apparatus on the tip of their rifle. It's like a little block that you can fire blanks out of. And I only know that from watching videos about special forces or training or something, but they had those on the rifles and no mags in the guns either. They're obviously doing some kind of training exercise, but I just find it so bizarre that, again, it's like this synchronicity kind of thing where the sequence of events is just so bizarre. I don't know how. Yeah, I don't think they were there to look for Bigfoot or anything, but I just find it a very interesting detail.
Yeah.
But yeah,
I have no idea what to make of that. Yeah.
Dude, I don't know either. Like, okay, so just imagine we're looking at like a little fairy dance party circle around our little chocolate cup offering site on this big slate rock, like 10 feet in front of us. And then like 20 army dudes walk by us down the trail with guns. And then like the little the orange fairy lights kind of just fade out as soon as they approach. And, you know, after that, they don't come back. So we're like, all right, let's just go to bed. And we do. And then we leave and we go home. And yeah, that's the story of the second time I went.
Wow. No less amazing than the first time.
Well, okay, so I've been 7 times. There's a lot more.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Is it practical just to give a catalog of the things that have happened?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know it would take a long time for me to like tell the detailed account, but the first two are probably the most important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let me think about it. So I'll just say the third time that we went, I went with only Julian. Stephen couldn't go. I can't remember. It was winter time. We didn't see anything. We didn't experience anything weird. We heard some like wood knocks, but I'll tell you, I didn't want to go there with the intention of like experiencing anything else, because I was like, my nervous system probably couldn't handle it. But what we did was I took, I'll just say, some entheogens or, you know, some substances with us, because I thought like maybe that could help facilitate some kind of paranormal activity of some kind. I'll tell you, I went to school in Seattle. Like, I've definitely had some experience with this stuff, and I always approached it through like a research lens, you know, like I never liked taking anything that altered my mood just to have fun. You know, I find that like kind of a waste. I don't approach it that way. So whenever I would do anything like that, I would always approach it like, oh, wouldn't it be fun to like try and see if we could communicate telepathically, which, thinking in hindsight, like, that's interesting that I tried to do that with my friends in Seattle. I was in school, but everyone was kind of lame and like into the whole frat party.
Right.
Crap. Yeah. And it's that's hilarious, Alex. Like, why are you such a nerd? It's like, dude, you're so boring. But yeah, so I decide like, it would be an interesting experiment to take like 3 grams out there and just see what happens. So we do that, and I have this vision of what I can only describe as like my body decaying in a like medieval knight's tomb or something. And it's like this green, very like ancient feeling of like some kind of, I hate the term past life, but something like that. I don't know what it was exactly. It was probably just the mushrooms, but something like that. Very medieval, which I find interesting, because I have this communication with something, and I don't know, obviously I don't know what it was. It could have just been my subconscious, but being in that spot, I don't think it was. It was something that told me that, you know, something very bad is going to happen to the earth very soon, and it's like I should prepare. And like coming home, I realized like, oh wait, this is like something that happens a lot with UFO experiencers, and
yep,
so often like a doomsday type of thing. And it's like, all right, I don't know if I should believe this or not, but I'm gonna write everything down and like just have this as reference, you know. So what it says besides that is that there is something very, and again, like, I'm only saying this because this is what happened. I'm not trying to sound self-aggrandizing or anything like that, because I don't like doing that. But they said there's something about my DNA that they're very interested in, particularly in my ancestry. I don't know why, but it's interesting that I had that vision of that medieval tomb and myself in that tomb. I also had a vision of something in the sky that was looked like a big circle within a circle, like a wheel with the spokes off of it. And that's what was trying to communicate with me. But obviously, like, when you take that dosage, it's hard to tell what your visual cortex is stimulating because of the substance and what is actually there or not sometimes, you know. But this was particularly interesting because I feel like whatever was up in the sky was actually there in a sense, you know. Mm-hmm. And what it's showing me, I'm seeing like all these symbols and hieroglyphics and very ancient looking things. And as I'm coming back down from the sensation of the substances, I get this feeling of like, wait a minute, maybe this is like what every religion was founded on initially, you know, was people taking these substances out in the woods and being contacted by whatever these entities are and having some kind of knowledge passed down through, you know, your brain being expanded by these things. And do you guys know what like the Eleusinian mysteries are?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it kind of made me think of that in a way.
I mean, even in this, there's a lot of stuff to unpack.
Yeah. There's just a lot.
Yeah. I mean, apocalyptic visions on certain substances are super common. You know, certain substances have their own character.
Right.
And, you know, it sounds like that is pretty consistent with what you experienced. You know, I'm on the death kick lately, so the fact that you saw yourself decaying means something. And, you know, I think that we're conditioned to dismiss a lot of these experiences as, you know, just quote-unquote hallucinations, but there does seem to be some sort of reality embedded in at least some of these experiences. And, you know, even if it was you mentioned earlier in regards to something else about it, you know, being your subconscious or something communicating with you, I don't think that makes it any less valid of an experience, even if it's wholly internal.
Definitely.
But I was wondering, again, to the degree that you're comfortable sharing, what is your heritage, do you know?
Yeah, I definitely looked into it. My family on my mother's side is English and French, I believe, and on my dad's side it's more recently from Russia, from St. Petersburg area. Mm. They moved here in like the 1900s, I believe.
Well, you know, it's always sort of dodgy to talk about bloodlines and whatnot in regards to this stuff. But, you know, there is that interesting conversation. I forget which book it's in, but Fale is talking to an old ex-Soviet agent who's basically scolding the U.S. because or basically, you know, Western Europe and whatnot, because we all killed our witches, so we sort of so we killed off our bloodlines that were more in touch with that. And he's made it a point to say, you know, we never had that sort of reaction in Russia with our witches. We never, in his words, like, you know, diluted the bloodline so that some of these talents could be passed on. I don't know if there's anything to that, but it's interesting.
Yeah, definitely. I know they absolutely persecuted witches in like the 1400s in England, for sure. I guess I'll just like run down real quick like some of the other things that have happened in that spot.
Yeah, please.
I think it's about time to mention the owl thing. So after the third time, I start doing a lot more in-depth research into what this whole thing is. And obviously I'm realizing that it's a huge, expansive spider web of different ideas and different subjects. And around this time I started to get like the weird dreams again of the hairy dudes, and I would wake up. This is another point in time where I was having an extremely hard time sleeping because, again, like the after effects were still very present. So I would go to sleep when it started to get light out, because I could not fall asleep when it was dark, because the darkness was so terrifying, you know. So I would go to sleep like at 5 a.m. and I would wake up. And this would happen so consistently that it would freak me out. I would wake up at 11:16, not every morning, but like very, very frequently. Like I would look at my clock, it's like, oh, 11:16. I did not mention that is the number that I've been seeing since I was a very small child, like 9/11, 116, those two in particular, for whatever reason, that's like my synchronicity number. So I would wake up, and I would wake up to an owl hooting at that time after having a Bigfoot dream.
Wow.
Yes. And this would happen consistently. This would happen like 3 nights in a row or something like that. It's not every morning or every night this would happen, but, you know, at least like twice a week, two or three times a week it would happen. And the other times it wouldn't happen, it was because like I was doing something or whatever. The fact that like my internal clock was so accurate that I would wake up at the exact same minute is interesting to me enough by itself. But the fact that an owl was hooting every single time, and every single time I would have a Bigfoot dream, was too much for me not to like, okay, what is the deal with the owl? Because they started to live in a tree outside my window, like outside my house around this time too. And it's like, so I started to do, I Googled like owl Bigfoot or owl UFO paranormal or something like that. And I came across like Mike Clellan's work, who I really like. I emailed him a couple times and we haven't connected yet, but I'd like to at some point. But yeah, I started reading his book and it's like, wait a minute, this is all the same stuff again, you know, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. the weird, the owl thing. After people see a UFO, like an owl shows up, or like after people have a weird mystical experience, an owl shows up and it's still there. Like I still hear it almost every day. It doesn't wake me up anymore. I think maybe it decided not to do that because I was falling asleep at a different time after I got over the trauma of the dark time. But here's another weird thing. The owl started to appear with other people. So I told some coworkers of mine who are two ladies that are like kind of into the witchy stuff, which I'm not. I'm definitely not. But they're definitely into the more like surface level manifesting, like that kind of stuff.
Right.
So I knew that they would be at least open to my experience. So I told them, and I think like a couple weeks after I mentioned that, Katie, she told me her mom saw like a dead owl on the side of a road or something. And she's like, oh, this reminds me of what you're telling me about the owl. And it's like the next day when I'm driving to Whole Foods, I see a dead owl on the side of the road and I took a picture of it. Hmm. And again, it's just like this weird synchronicity relation to all of these like literal symbols, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I had a bunch of owl stuff happen only after I read The Messengers.
Yeah. Okay. That's so strange. Because it definitely ramped up while I was reading that book for sure.
And I don't know if it's the kind of thing, you know, it's like the whole thing with like the number 23, and they say, well, you're just aware of it, so you start seeing 23 everywhere.
Recognition bias or cognitive bias or something.
Yeah. But either way, it happened. It was in conjunction with other things that it was happening to. Which
yeah. So that's why I find it interesting, is because it happened. You know, I would hear it at the exact moment that I was seeing the number. That right. I always saw, in conjunction with like these weird events, you know what I mean? Eventually I took those two girls with me to the woods. While we were out there, an owl flew right over my face while I was lying down on my back.
Oh wow.
It flew direct like inches above my head. They saw it. I've since like been fine with bringing like cameras out there after like the fifth or sixth time, because when I was first bringing people out there, I was like very hopeful that something would happen. And I think like not recording things might facilitate maybe a little bit more of a chance, if that makes sense. You know, they might be a little bit weirded out by recordings or something like that.
I definitely have a theory with video, and I've borrowed this from Tobe Johnson, who said it to me. He said, it's, you know, as regards to this phenomenon, it's almost like we're not allowed to video it, but audio's okay. For some reason, it lets us take audio recordings all the time.
They say that about like the phenomenon at Skinwalker Ranch too. Like it kind of evades the area where the cameras are or something. Mm-hmm. Before I forget, what's interesting is you know that thermal imaging footage that what's his name, Michael Green recorded. In that video, the figures swaying back and forth behind a tree, which mm-hmm. is exactly what we saw. It's just an interesting note. That's kind of what makes me believe it might be legitimate footage. Obviously, there's no way of knowing for sure.
Right, right.
This is something that I think about a lot. Even if there is legitimate footage of Bigfoot or a UFO, it's never going to convince anybody. There's no point in trying to get footage of this.
Especially now that we're in the age of incredibly realistic CGI and CGI that's available to, you know, you don't have to work for a major movie studio to get good with it. Yeah, no one's ever. You're not going to convince anybody with video. Yeah. Thing. Yeah.
I've recorded footage of the orbs, and it looks like just a little speck of light. It's
100%. 100%. There's a place I go. I don't know if you've heard me talk about it, called Site 7, where we see the lights constantly, and people are like, film them, film them, film them. Whenever we film them, still pictures or moving, you know, or film.
Yeah.
They, what looks to me like, you know, a considerably sized red or green light, you know, anomalous light in the woods, it looks like a white speck on the film.
Do you know who Chris Bledsoe is?
No.
He is a...
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, Joshua knows. So he's a pretty well-known experiencer in the UFO community, especially now, because he was the first investigation by ATIP, I believe, which was like the Tom DeLonge, Lou Elizondo thing. Or I could get that. I'm probably getting that wrong, but he had this encounter basically with, just like balls of light in the woods and like invisible footsteps and a little creature with his family, multiple witnesses, and again like the after effects. And he also mentions like seeing some kind of like lady in white, which I know you guys are interested in.
Oh yeah.
Which got the attention of like the Vatican or something, and he says like he has contacts with the CIA or stuff like that. Anyway, so I've talked to him on the phone.
Yeah, because he's not too terribly far from you.
No, he's in Fayetteville. Yeah, that's like a couple hours away. I want to see if he will talk with me for my documentary project. But anyway, so he records these orbs and posts them on Instagram, and it's just like he uses a what's called like a digital night vision camera. I actually have the same model as him, I believe, but what he posts are just like these little specks of light that go across the sky in a straight line and basically mimic the pattern of a satellite. And it's just so I know he's telling the truth because I've experienced it for myself, but from an outside observer, it's like, that's just a satellite, man. I'm sorry. Like, having said that, let me tell you something really weird. So the last time I was out there, I brought the Psionics night vision camera with me, and I was like, all right, I'm gonna do my best. I'm gonna like leave out some chocolate and see if I can get anything. If nothing happens, that's totally fine. I don't care. Like, I know that footage is not gonna convince anyone. This is only for my personal film project. But anyway, so I got footage of it. But guess what? I see the orb in the sky because they show up every time I'm there, which is awesome. I'm very grateful for that. Like, I appreciate it. So it shows up, and it's just one of them. It's like orange and yellow, and which is kind of, that's abnormal. It's not normally that color. It's normally bluish white or orange. It's like this pale yellow color, and it's doing like the same sort of zigzaggy falling leaf motion. And I'm like, all right, hey, cool, this is great. If you can hear my thoughts, like, do you mind sticking around so I can record you? And it starts to fade out, like a little bit. It's still there. And I'm like, I take that as a maybe, you know. And so I bring the camera out, and it's still there. It's still doing the same little motion. And as soon as I turn it on, it brightens up, and it starts to fly in a straight line. And I swear to God, and I can show you this video too, because it's crazy. But it starts to fly in a straight line at the exact same pattern, at the exact same rate as a satellite. I see a bunch of satellites out there because there's no light pollution. But maybe what Chris Bledsoe is recording are legitimately whatever these things are. I don't know because I'm not there. But it's just so bizarre that they mimic or seem to mimic, I don't know, like known objects. So,
yeah. I've talked to several people whom I trust very highly who have experienced stuff at his property. And, you know, I'm inclined to think it's all credible. Yeah. Yeah,
I am too. But again, it's like the phenomenon negates itself.
Mm-hmm.
Some reason. Yep. It's just kind of like, all right, I know you're observing me, so I'm just going to try and act like a known object. So strange. Also forgot to mention, we also saw a blue orb at our feet. We had separate tents. The girls had their own tent, and I set up my tent across from them, and we had a blue orb the size of a basketball float down and sit directly in between us that night.
Wow.
Yes. They also saw a figure in the shadows that I did not see, but that's just them. That's basically everything that has happened at that spot. I brought my brother out there a couple months ago. We saw... My brother is a very staunch non-believer. He thinks this is all ridiculous, which I think I think some people have like a whole like little ego thing where it's like, I am not going to believe in anything ridiculous because I'm a smart, rational person. They kind of take pride in that. And I'm like, dude, you realize like nobody knows anything about anything in reality, that everything that is written down is mostly just, I mean, you guys know what I'm saying. Like, there's no, like, consensus reality is not true reality, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So anyway, so my brother and I saw this, like, color-changing orb that was doing the same exact, like, falling leaf motion. And we also heard, he told me while we were out there, like, Alex, I think I heard something that sounded like a baby monkey. And he was a little freaked out. But as soon as we got home, he was like, that was probably a bird. It's like, dude,
right.
You did not think it was a bird while we were out there. But whenever I try to ask him about the UFO we saw, he's like, yeah, that was weird, Alex, but I don't know what it was. Mm-hmm. So anyway.
I want to go there.
Yeah, I would absolutely take you guys. I would actually love that.
Let's do it, Tim. Let's do it, and we'll do a tour of you can come on down, and I can show you the few things that there are down here too in Atlanta.
Well, let's do it. I need to do it. It's going to be during the colder months though, cuz I am not liking this summer weather.
Oh, not this year.
I wanted to ask you guys a couple things. I've been doing a lot of research, obviously. I'm curious if you are familiar with, I have her book right now, Mary A. Joyce, who wrote a book about the Cherokee Little People, especially in the North Carolina area.
It's been recommended to me several times, but I've not read it.
Is this the Cherokee Little People Are Real book?
Yes.
That book is...
It's a little ridiculous, I know.
I would call it a hoot. Yeah.
That's why I asked you about it.
I think there's some good ethnographic research in there. But for those who don't know, it almost sort of circles around this. I would almost call it a conspiracy that Western Carolina University in Cullowhee is like deliberately got rid of Cherokee little people dwellings and bodies.
She also wrote a book about like the miracles of Jesus being actually real too, which makes me a little dubious in its own sense, but. Yeah.
Well, I think the problem that I would have with that book is that it's a little bit too literal-minded about what these things are and the way that they operate. You know, the idea that, no, there actually are, you know, tunnels with Nunyanahi skeletons. It's like, I don't think that's quite the way it works.
I know, right. Yeah, whenever anyone starts to talk about, like, the Smithsonian and skeletons, I'm like, you were brainwashed by Facebook or, like, conspiracy theories.
A couple of follow-up questions, Alex.
Yeah.
When you go out there, are you greeted with that creepy feeling now?
Yes, I sometimes still do. The last time I was there, I went to the exact spot that everything seems to happen, and I felt sick to my stomach. So I had to, like, go closer to my car a little bit to film the orbs. I was also alone. This is the first time I was by myself since the first time in August of two years ago.
That was my next question. Have you gone back alone? Okay.
Now, I haven't spent the night alone yet because, like, I'm starting to think about this in a way of, like, I'm familiar with what shamanic initiation is. I still don't understand it at all, but I am familiar with that term. I kind of believe that's what happened the first time. I think that there are some interesting parallels between what happened to me and the history of, like, secret society initiation rituals, like the sensory deprivation, the fear, the deliberate frightening of the subject or whatever you want to call it, the initiate. I don't know if there's a direct correlation, but there seems to be a couple, in my opinion. I'm curious what you guys think about that. But to answer your question, no, I've not been out there and spent the night alone yet.
So if, like, someone could somehow predict the future and they said, like, you know, you're going to go out there on your next visit and you're going to spend the night, you're going to see, you know, one or more of these creatures is going to walk right into your campsite. You're going to have an up close and personal sighting of this thing. Would you do it?
Yeah, I would probably vomit. I imagine. Yeah. I mean, I find this too interesting to pass up, honestly.
It is addictive, isn't it?
A little bit.
Yeah. When that bug bites you, you live with the sting. Yeah.
It's definitely a little concerning to people who are kind of outside of my personal circle that know about this thing that happened. You know, it's a little frustrating to try and talk about your work with people that don't really want to hear it or understand it, you know?
I don't know. The overall answer is I don't know. The only advice I can give is every now and then just take a break from it, do something else.
Oh, I was going to say that. Yeah, that's funny you say that. My whole routine with this is I do one day on, one day off where I think of this.
That's like, probably a good idea.
So literally every single morning that I wake up, I have to think about it. for at least a half a second, because it's like, it's still so, I don't, there's something about trauma and like being ingrained in your immediate consciousness, or I don't know, something about that that makes me think about it as soon as I wake up in the morning. And then, yeah, like every other day I'll be like, nope, I'm not going to think about that today. Mm-hmm. So far that's been keeping me sane.
Yeah. I think it's for mental health reasons. I think it's very important because there is an addictive nature to this. I mean, I can get absolutely obsessed by it.
Yeah. And there's, again, there's no way of, as far as I'm aware, procuring any sort of anything concrete relating to this, you know, there's no real way of like meshing this with like the Neil deGrasse Tyson types. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it doesn't work with materialist stuff. It just doesn't.
Yeah, that's the word. Thank you. Exactly.
Alex, I hate to predict things, but I guess that you're going to have more, and I hope you'll keep in touch and let us know.
Definitely. Yeah, I'd like to keep talking for sure.
Yeah, please do.
And I think I speak for Timothy when I say that had we known about your experience before Where the Footprints End came out and you had granted us permission, you would have been one of the case studies in the back.
Oh, because absolutely.
It combines so many things.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
You hit everything. I think I was like,
I know that's why it's so weird, man. That's why I feel in order for me to like tell my family about this, because like I have grandparents and relatives that are not going to be fine with this if I like just come out and say it. I have to make some kind of like, I don't want to say like entertainment product, but you know, like I'm working on a documentary about this, you know, that is going to take a very somewhat grounded, somewhat rational perspective on this, because that's where I came from initially before this encounter. You know, I was not a person who believed in fairies. I would laugh at that, honestly. Mm-hmm. There's one more thing that I wanted to ask you. Are you guys familiar with, there's like this thing that I've kind of come across of like these novels or stories that have been written that the author says are true, but they're often like discounted as like a fiction or a fable. But they often like are stories of like people going underground and meeting like Edda Dorpa. I don't know if you're familiar with that. Like the
Edda Dorpa, or like the Shaver. Yeah, the Shaver mysteries.
Yeah, Shaver. Yeah.
Or the Vril people. Mm-hmm. It was written by the Dark and Stormy Night guy. I forget his name off the top of my head. Oh, okay. One last thing that I wanted to mention. Are you guys familiar with, I think his name is Edward Sturgis Ingraham or Ingram?
I can't say that I am.
Yeah, okay. It's not ringing bells for me.
Okay. All right. This is something that I think you guys need to look up. He was a mountaineer from Seattle, a Freemason, interesting detail, who wrote a account of meeting he called it a hairy old man in a cave while out on an expedition to Mount Rainier. And he said that he felt the exact same sensation that I felt, which was like the spine tingling, telepathic communication, balls of light. And yeah, this is the earliest recording of a like psychic Bigfoot thing that I can find. It's from, I almost swore again, from 1895. And it's like, it's, you know, this is not like a Facebook conspiracy meme. This is like, it's in a book published that I haven't found a physical copy of yet, but I found like scans of it, and they have a copy in the University of Washington Library, and I'm trying to see if they'll let me look at it. But
wow.
Yeah, look up Edward Sturgis Ingraham, old man of the crater or something.
Okay, yeah. I think I have heard this story.
Yeah.
I think it was compiled in Rosemary Ellen Guiley's Planet Bigfoot. I think there's an essay that mentions it. But yeah, it does sort of touch on those subterranean themes, which is, I mean, you know, you had mentioned the presence of gold mining in the Uaris, and that's another one of those Tim Rennerisms where I was like, nah, that's not a thing. Buried treasure theory, and you know, my in-laws just moved to a part of Florida that has like probably the third most skunk ape sightings. And my mother-in-law was like, yeah, it's kind of funny. You know, we didn't really hear stories about Bigfoot growing up, but we always heard stories about pirates coming up the river and burying treasure. And I'm like, oh, okay, there you go.
Yeah. Yeah. When you said there was gold mining in the area, it was just like, cha-ching, check another box. You know,
it was the site of that forest was the site of like the first gold rush in America in like the 1700s, I believe. I also know that quartz deposits are directly related to gold veins or something like
that. Yeah, they are. Yep.
I really appreciate you guys talking with me.
This is wonderful.
Absolutely. Please stay in touch.
Yeah, it's so nice to talk to people that understand, honestly. Yeah, it makes me feel good.
So, Josh, you have some appearances coming up?
I do. It looks like conferences are back in rotation. So I'm actually doing three in the latter half of the summer. The first one is August 5th through 7th in Cape Girardeau, Missouri. It's the Midwest Conference on the Unknown, and it is a stacked roster. I'm so happy to be a part of it. It's like Micah Hanks, Ryan Sprague, Ken Gerhart, Steve Ward, a bunch of people, including Michael Huntington, who's organizing it. So it's just an absolute awesome roster. And then there's like a long weekend at a retreat in Franklin Grove, Illinois, August 11th through 14th at the Worldwide Metaphysical Tribe is what it's called. And I'll be doing a Where the Footprints End talk there. And we're also going to be calling down a UFO. And then anyone in the Atlanta area, for the first time after years of saying, hey, can I come? Hey, can I come? Hey, can I come? I will be at DragonCon September 1st through September 5th in Atlanta, Georgia. So come on out to any of those. I'd love to see people.
There's a puppy I'd like to visit on our walk.
There are two puppies you like to visit.
Yes. One's a pug and one's a beagle. I think they might be my best friends. They are perfect puppies. Actually, I really don't know.
They could be really terrible inside the house. We only see them when they're outside having fun.
I get to do the fun stuff with them. I get to pet them and hang out with them a little bit. But I would take them home if I could. But I know if their owner came to me and said, these two, I need help. I know where I'd send them. Do you know where I'd send them, Allison?
I do. To our house. And then you would call Tina at 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy.
Absolutely. 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy can help you with all your puppy training needs. They have a relationship-based approach that helps you and your puppy become perfect for each other. They have online sources like video lessons. They have a secret Facebook group, much better than those not-secret Facebook groups. They have one-on-one options also, of course. You can find them at sithappens.us. There's a 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy link at the top of the page there. 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy can help you understand how your dog thinks and apply proactive training methods so you and your puppy can become perfect for each other. Once again, if you have a puppy and need help training, 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy can help you. You can find them at sithappens.us. Look for the 90 Days to the Perfect Puppy link at the top of the page. We're going to have more with Alex, even more with Alex. I thought of some things after I talked to Alex, and I emailed him some things that happened to Chad and I around Pandemonium. And we started talking, and he started remembering some other things that he didn't tell me. I said, you know what? Going back, let's talk, and let's compare notes and talk about these weird dreams and things some more. So we're going to do yet another episode with Alex, but that's a patron episode. To hear that, you got to be a patron. Patreon.com/strangefamiliars. We'll be dropping that pretty soon. That'll be the first patron episode of the month. The second patron episode of the month is also related kind of tangentially to this episode. It's Josh Kutchin and I talking about some folk tales and ghost stories from the Uwaris. So it's, you know, kind of related because Alex's whole story takes place in the Uwari National Forest there. So there's more with Alex, patreon.com/strangefamiliars. H.P. Lovecraft. People like him, right?
I think they do. We've been to his grave.
We have, a couple times.
What else is there in Providence, Rhode Island?
Anais Nin's grave?
Yeah, I think that was originally why we went there.
There's a couple other people in that cemetery as well.
Yeah, it's what I think it's one of the coolest cemeteries I've actually ever been. Is it Swan Point?
I think so. Providence, Rhode Island.
It's one of the cool cemeteries in the world.
The one time we went to Lovecraft's grave, somebody had graffitied that is not dead, which can eternal lie, or whatever thing for the quote.
In like goth girl magic marker. It was really cheesy.
Yeah, please don't do that to his grief. He would have put it on there if he wanted that on.
Yeah.
Another time there was crab claws left on his grave.
At least that's biodegradable.
Exactly. It's not permanent, at least. Well, I'm sure that the marker wasn't permanent either. I'm sure somebody scrubbed that off, but they shouldn't have had to.
Yeah. He's not Jim Morrison.
He's not. In fact, he barely sung for the Doors.
Yeah, like just that one album.
So these old paperbacks, and we can call them old now.
I'd like to add that this paperback is actually younger than both of us.
Is it? Is it younger than both of us? I thought it was younger than me, but not you.
Can you say it was from 76?
This paperback is younger than both of us. This old paperback is younger than both of us. No, but I love these old mass market paperbacks. I collect the paranormal ones a lot, and some of the horror ones, if they're interesting.
Oh, but they always have good covers.
Yeah.
The 60s ones always have like really cool psychedelic kind of covers to them, and this looks like it's straight out of a D&D module.
It really does. So this is the mass market paperback, H.P. Lovecraft, The Case of Charles Dexter Ward.
Have you read that one?
I'm sure I did at some point.
Are there a bunch of consonants jammed all up together in it?
A young man cursed by the ultimate invocation of evil. Among the best fiction of H.P. Lovecraft, says August Derleth. So we are pulling this from our collection and offering it up as the curiosity of the week. It's in pretty good condition.
Yeah.
A lot of these old mass market paperbacks are pretty beat up. This one's in pretty nice condition. We'll put a image of this in the show notes. If you click on that, it'll take you to our Etsy shop where you can purchase this and other curiosities of the week. We might add some more uranium glass.
And some Dutchy stuff, Pennsylvania Dutchy stuff.
Oh, yeah. Go to Etsy to check out the H.P. Lovecraft book. Check out our other stuff at Etsy. Artwork, copies of my books, t-shirts, and more. We were temporarily sold out of size medium of the High Strangeness Tour shirts just because I counted wrong. It said sold out before. I went up the other day, and we do have a couple mediums. So if you were in a medium of the High Strangeness Tour shirt, we do have them. I think we have one small or two smalls, one or two mediums, and one large as we're recording this. So that's it. Once those are gone, they will not be made again. While you're at Etsy, check out our friends at Karmic Garden and Chad Shop as well, Ruck Rabbit Outdoors. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back soon with more Strange Familiars. Strange Familiars is a production of Dark Holler Arts, music, books, art, podcasts, and more. Intro and background music is by Stone Breath. If you want to hear more or purchase music, you can go to stonebreath.bandcamp.com. Strange Familiars is on Facebook, facebook.com/strangefamiliars. We have the Strange Familiars gathering group there. We're also on Instagram, @strangefamiliars. That's one word. And you can find us on the web at strangefamiliars.com.
Woo! Thank you.
daughter dear, and she would have married me. But I forsook my house and land and all for the love of thee. If you could have married a king's daughter dear, I'm sure you are to blame. For I am married to the house carpenter. They say he's a fine young man.
Where you and I must go.